From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Golly Superman, we talk with Jack Larson. He played Jimmy Olsen, the cub reporter, on the TV series Superman. Later, he became a playwright and librettist and kept his Jimmy Olsen identity secret. We'll hear some of his work. There's a new recording of an opera that Larson collaborated on with the composer Virgil Thompson. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review. Also, we talk with painter Larry Rivers about painting nude portraits of his mother-in-law and son. And Gary Paulson reads from his new memoir, Eastern Sun, Winter Moon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton stepped up the fight to pass his economic stimulus package today, blaming Republican senators for blocking a $300 million child immunization program. The president charged the GOP was holding American children hostage. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Seizing a popular element of his $16.3 billion stimulus proposal, the president accused Republican senators of playing politics and ignoring the needs of American children. While the administration is looking for a compromise to win over the support of key senators, the president appealed to a group of New England business leaders today to help put the pressure on Congress.
And if you've been following the filibuster in the Senate, you know that just a few people can stop action on important economic legislation by talking and talking and talking.
With the help of one conservative Democrat, Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama, Republicans have stalled a vote on the president's stimulus legislation. Minority Leader Bob Dole says the filibuster is a warning to the administration not to overlook the GOP. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
About 600 National Guardsmen have been assembled at staging areas around Los Angeles today in case there's violence after a jury delivers its verdict in the trial of four L.A. police officers. The officers are accused of violating the civil rights of Rodney King when they were videotaped beating him following a traffic stop. The officers' acquittals in a state trial last year led to the Los Angeles riots. The L.A. Police Department has put an extra 200 officers on the streets at all times. Inmates at Ohio's maximum security prison continue to hold eight guards hostage. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
Ohio's top corrections official is now saying the hostage takers inside the Lucasville prison may have planned their hostage taking for a long time. The eight guard hostages had rushed into the prison Easter Sunday afternoon to put down what they thought was a fight among inmates. But now Ohio Corrections Director Reggie Wilkinson says the fight may have been staged. The guards are reportedly alive, but the rioting did claim the lives of six prisoners. Officials say the slain inmates were beaten to death by their fellow prisoners. All of the dead inmates were white, but corrections officials maintain there's no evidence race was a factor. Prisoners are pressing their list of 19 demands, among them access to news reporters. But so far, negotiators haven't reached agreement on that. Meanwhile, they've cut off electricity and water to the cell block the rioting inmates control. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
Stock prices closed sharply higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 32 points to close at 3,428. Advances led declines by a margin of more than 2-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. NATO warplanes began the first patrols over Bosnia today, enforcing a UN ban on military flights by any of the parties in the Bosnian Civil War. The ban is aimed at the Bosnian Serbs, who have the only significant air force in the conflict, but its impact is expected to be largely symbolic. That's because the year-long civil war has been fought primarily on the ground. A French Mirage jet fighter that was part of the NATO force went down today over the Adriatic Sea. French military officials said the crash was apparently caused by mechanical problems and that the pilot has been safely rescued. Milwaukee health officials say it appears that one person has died in an outbreak of diarrhea caused by a waterborne parasite. Beth Graham of member station WUWM reports.
Milwaukee Deputy Health Commissioner Dr. Tom Schlenker says it is probable that cryptosporidium diarrhea led to the death last week of a woman who was in the advanced stages of lung cancer. At a daily briefing on Milwaukee's water crisis, Schlenker said the woman, who had been receiving chemotherapy, was admitted to a local hospital April 6th, suffering from diarrhea. The woman was in an advanced state of dehydration and shock. Schlenker said her condition rapidly worsened and she died the next day. Health Department officials had warned early last week that diarrhea caused by cryptosporidium was the biggest threat to the very young and old and people with weakened immune systems. That includes AIDS patients and people receiving treatment for cancer. For National Public Radio, I'm Beth Graham in Milwaukee.
The FBI disclosed today that religious sect leader David Koresh has sent authorities a second letter threatening divine retribution if Koresh is harmed. FBI spokesman Bob Rick said that Koresh sent them letters on Friday and Saturday, telling them that the letters contained a message from God. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Who would have guessed that the actor who always had to say, "Golly, Superman," would go on to become a librettist, playwright, poet, and movie producer? In a few minutes, we'll talk with Jack Larson about the years he played Jimmy Olsen on the TV series Superman. First, our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has a review of an opera, Lord Byron, composed by the late Virgil Thompson with a libretto by Jack Larson. Thompson's best-known works include two operas he collaborated on with Gertrude Stein, Four Saints and Three Acts, and The Mother of Us All, which is about Susan B. Anthony. Thompson and Larson finished writing Lord Byron in 1972. Lloyd has a review of the first complete recording of it, which has just been released.
Virgil Thompson's Lord Byron may be the most famous unproduced opera in history. It was commissioned by the Metropolitan, but has never had a complete, fully staged professional production. In the summer of 1991, conductor James Boley presented an uncut concert version at the Monadnock Music Festival in New Hampshire. Now Koch International has released a recording of that performance. Like Thompson's other operas, Lord Byron is a celebration of unconventionality. It's really more about what Byron represents to others than it is about the notoriously unconventional hero himself. The plot revolves around Byron's heirs trying to get the deceased poet's remains buried in Westminster Abbey's Poet's Corner. Through a series of flashbacks, we see scenes that explain why, at the end, Westminster Abbey refuses the request, and why his friends decide to burn Byron's memoirs. In the midst of the action, the caustic ghost of Byron wanders in and out, making satirical remarks. Here's one of the flashbacks. Byron and Lady Byron, tenor Matthew Lord and mezzo-soprano Donna Fortunato, are paying a visit to Byron's half-sister, Augusta Lee, soprano Jean Omerley, who has just given birth to a daughter who might actually be Byron's.
He says,
"Kisses, kisses,
give your baby.
Kisses,
give your baby kisses.
Can you detect in the words an indirect tribute to Gertrude Stein? The remarkable libretto, which effortlessly incorporates actual lines of Byron, is by the poet and playwright Jack Larson. Does that name ring a bell? You might remember Larson better as the young actor who played cub reporter Jimmy Olsen on the original Superman TV series. Thompson's music ranges all over the stylistic landscape. We get waltzes and hymns, rounds, marches, and sentimental ballads, Auld Lang Syne, Ach du lieber Augustin, and the Marseillaise, sometimes several of these at the same time. Here's one of the prettiest tunes. It's Byron serenading some of his admirers with his philosophy of love. Lord Byron gets better and better as it goes along. The music is kaleidoscopically unpredictable, rhythmically alive, and full of the most infectious melodies. At the opening night in New Hampshire, Jack Larson commented that the performers were doing it right. Thompson and Larson were, too. Now we can finally hear that for ourselves.
Lord Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Lord Byron on the Koch International label. How did the librettist Jack Larson get to the world of opera after the many years he spent as a cub reporter on the Daily Planet? We invited him to talk with us about playing Jimmy Olsen on TV. Superman premiered in 1953, ran to 1959, and has remained on the air in syndication. Now it's on cable's Nick at Night. Larson's acting career started before Superman when he was a contract actor for Warner Brothers. He gave up acting shortly after Superman because he thought typecasting was preventing him from landing good roles. Since his days of getting rescued by the Man of Steel, Larson has collaborated with such prominent composers as Ned Roram, Charles Fussell, and David Diamond. He was a producer of several films, including Bright Lights, Big City, The China Syndrome, The Paper Chase, and Urban Cowboy. He's also written several plays. I asked him if composer Virgil Thompson ever watched Superman.
I'm sure he watched Superman. Virgil did. We never talked about it, but he was very proud of me being on Superman when it came out that I was. I had kept it a secret. I hadn't talked about it because I felt if anybody knew that the Jack Larson that was writing the plays and working with eminent composers was Jimmy Olsen, that the sky would fall in on me like Chicken Little and I would lose my writing career, work, life, as well as my acting work life. So I never mixed the two. Virgil, it happened, I got exposed as Jimmy Olsen.
How?
Through a ballet that I had written the text for called The Relativity of Icarus that had a lot of press in New York, and there was a press conference called by the Joffrey. And the Associated Press, the New York Post, when I appeared at this press conference, they knew that I was Jimmy Olsen. And they wrote about it. And I thought, oh, golly, you know, the sky is going to fall in on me. It didn't. And then I was asked to do, Tom Brokaw asked me to do the Today Show. And I did a number of things, and I felt this is going to be my ruin. And it wasn't, and it turned out that people were very happy for me that I wasn't lying in a gutter somewhere as an old actor out of work, you know.
How did you get the role as Jimmy Olsen on Superman?
Times weren't easy with the demise of the Hollywood contract system, and I got a part in a play, and that play was supposed to get to New York. We didn't get to New York, but we played very glamorously in Los Angeles, and at that point, I was offered another stock contract at 20th Century Fox and a part in a film, and I didn't want another stock contract at a studio. By that time, I wanted to go to Broadway, New York, here I come, and I didn't have any money. You know, you got equity minimum for doing a play. And I was offered the Superman television show, which was one of the first shows ever filmed. Nobody knew what it was. There had been no film television, only live television. And so I was hesitant to do it. And the people that wanted me very much said, look, it's like doing a Saturday morning serial. You know, for theater serials. No one will ever see it. You're a very difficult kid. You don't want another stock contract. You don't want this. You don't want that. You want to get to New York? Well, take the money and run and do this. So I signed on to play Jimmy Olsen in Superman. It didn't go on the air for 2 years. We shot that in the summer of 1951, summer and fall. And I was in New York working in live television when Superman went on the air, and it became instantly very popular, and my character became popular, and I became Jimmy Olsen.
Well, you were interested in writing, in serious acting, and here you were on Superman playing this golly gee whiz naive cub reporter. It sounds like you were really nothing like the character you were playing. Did you enjoy playing that kind of role? Did it get annoying after a while?
I loved playing Jimmy. And I now, all these years later, regard it as a fulfillment of myself as an actor. I think Jimmy was, it was my part. Being a pioneer in television like that, in film television, they were so busy technically learning how to film a show quickly that they let us all alone as performers. And they let me create Jimmy, and I had a wonderful time doing it and worked with first-rate character actors, people like George E. Stone, Sterling Holloway, Elizabeth Patterson. And you learn from these people who were major actors from the theater and in films. And I wanted to do comedy and comedy bits, and they'd let me alone. And once I became popular, they really let me alone to just do what I wanted to do. So you were like a pioneer in the early days of silent films, a two-reel comedy, doing television.
How many times were you kidnapped as Jimmy Olsen?
Oh, I don't know, probably every third show I was kidnapped as Jimmy and had a bomb. If I was ever kidnapped, I was either tied to a chair with a bomb at my feet or sealed in a room somewhere that Superman couldn't see through because there was mysterious lead in the brick or something. But that never bothered me. What bothered me was the writers and the producers they liked to have Jimmy nearly drown. And they used to like to get me wet, like put me in a cave, and the tide is coming in the cave, and the cave has bars, and Jimmy is going to be drowned. This was a holdover, I guess, from the old Saturday morning serials, as I said. And the problem with that, I never mind being wet. I will do anything as an actor, but you get sick. Because once they get you wet, if you've got work to do afterwards, you stay wet. And the next day work, if you're rescued, for instance, Superman would come in and rescue, tear back the bars of the cave and carry Jimmy out, who would say, golly, Superman, I never thought you'd get here in time. I thought I was a goner for sure. And I'd be carried outside dripping wet. Well, your next scenes, all your next work, the resolution, you're still wet. They come with a hose and wet you down. And I would always catch a cold. Sound stages are cold. And it drove me crazy. And they never cared. And I finally told them, it was about the second season and my 10th wet show. And I said, listen, I don't want to seem a spoil sport, but I don't like working sick. And I catch a cold in these cold sound stages, so quit. You can regard me from now on as a dry actor.
My guest is Jack Larson. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest Jack Larson played Jimmy Olsen in the TV series Superman. He's now a playwright, librettist, poet, and producer. Years ago, it was just like the first year I was in radio, it was in the mid-70s, I think, I interviewed Noelle Neal, your co-star. She was...
Oh, did you?
She was Lois Lane.
Yes, she's a darling person.
Well, one of the questions I asked her was this. I said, I remember all these episodes where you were kidnapped and you were tied up and you were wriggling around while you were, you know, in bondage. And so, sometimes you'd be dressed in the chiffon robe and you were supposed to be sacrificed until Superman came and rescued you. And I said,
right.
You know, did you ever think about the kind of S&M type of image that was? And she said, we never thought about those kinds of things.
No.
Did you really
right.
never think about those kinds of things?
No, I really didn't. I know the show you're referring to where the ancient cult kidnapped both of us in a tomb and they stripped me. I'm in like a jock strap or something, little thing, and she's in a beautiful filmy thing and we're tied to pillars or something and they're going to kill us. And I guess it was wild S&M. I don't know. No, I never thought about it. We were too busy working. We never thought about a lot of things, you know. I always played the Jimmy, dumb enough. I felt that Jimmy was so dumb that he couldn't tell Superman was Clark Kent because Clark Kent wore a pair of horn-rimmed glasses.
Right, right.
And I thought, if you're that unaware, and any kind of a thing. Once actually Clark Kent, there's one show where Jimmy's beside him and Clark Kent has fallen through his shower door and he's in bed and Jimmy seems to be sharing the apartment at that time or something. He's taking care of him and Clark Kent does not have on his glasses and Jimmy doesn't even still recognize him as Superman. And I pointed it out to the director and the producer. I said, well, now, you know, here we are and he doesn't have on these glasses because he's fallen through his glass shower door. And they said, oh, don't think about it. That's opening up a can of peas. Just play the scene, so I did.
You know how earlier you were telling us that when you started working in music, when you started working with opera and art song, that you kept your Jimmy Olsen part of your life a secret because you thought it would hurt your credibility and people wouldn't want to work with you.
Yes.
How did you keep it a secret? Nobody recognized your name or your face?
Well, people did, but they didn't. People later told me they thought I was very foolish not to enjoy it more. But they could tell. I mean, I was really scarred. I see that now. And I would never do publicity. For instance, I was certainly later when I produced a film with Michael J. Fox. I was as popular as Michael. And had it been now, I would have segued right into a major film. I mean, you can hardly, if you're popular in a television series, they want you to star in a film. That didn't exist then. You were the enemy if you were a television actor or a star. And right away, it scared me in New York, as I said, when the show went on the air. And I never did any publicity. I would never pose for a picture. I would never do publicity. Magazines wanted to do articles on me. I wouldn't do it. And indeed, I never did publicity until when I said the Joffrey, this big explosion, a kind of scandal happened with the ballet, The Relativity of Icarus, and then when it all came out, and then I thought, oh, why not? Because people write about you anyway. They already were writing about me without me giving the interviews and getting things wrong. So I did it, and but you wouldn't find a picture of me for publication. I never posed for a picture in a bow tie. I wouldn't do it. And it made a very bad relationship, I can say, on their behalf. I understand their problem with this actor who they could have exploited.
Yeah. During the part of your life where you were keeping Jimmy Olsen a secret, did you make up a past or did you just not talk about the past?
No, I didn't talk about it. And all I can say is that apparently it was so apparent that I didn't want to talk about it, that people didn't talk to me about it. Like Frank O'Hara, Joe LeSueur, all the people. Later, they talked about it. I think it was John Ashbery who said to me that he always was amazed I didn't enjoy it more, you know. And I was aware that people would stare at me in restaurants or people would come up and it would embarrass me to sign autographs or things. But nobody would say anything. So, and I didn't have a wide, you know, really wide circle of friends like that. My closest friend during all those years was Montgomery Clift, really. And Monty was very reclusive. And so socially, often we go out to dinner and stuff. But when you're forbidding... people don't bother you. And I was certainly forbidding. And as I said, when off time, I would grow a beard and do things. And I realized it was very neurotic behavior.
When George Reeves, who played Superman, committed suicide, did you understand it? Were you prepared for something like that?
I wasn't prepared for George to commit suicide. As a matter of fact, I was working in Germany at the time at a place called the Bavaria Filmkunst. I'd gotten a gig there as an actor, and my next stop was Italy, and then come back to Los Angeles to do 26 more Superman. George was doing costume fittings at the time, and I knew I had to go to work again. But I knew he was depressed. He had the same problem I had. He couldn't get a job as an actor. And so I really wasn't surprised. And he'd had a long relationship with, I thought, a wonderful woman who he split up with. They'd been together for 15 years, and I thought that might have depressed him. So I wasn't surprised. I don't want to do something current affairs-y, but a lot of people think he was murdered. His mother thought he was murdered. I believe Noel thinks that. A lot of people think that it was not a natural, wasn't a suicide. Hmm. And indeed, I saw with my own eyes 3 bullet holes in his bedroom. I was one of the first people to go into the house with the woman that inherited the house, Tony Mannix, who is the woman who lived with him all those years. And I saw 3 bullet holes. It only takes one to... I believe he committed suicide. If you're, since I've clouded the issue and all, I could understand that he'd committed suicide, and it was one of the things that made me quit acting. I thought, I'm not going to further depress myself fighting this thing of being typed. I've got other things to do. I can write.
Let me get back to your new opera, or the new recording of an opera from several years ago. Do you think that this new recording might lead to another production of the opera?
Well, we hope, and Virgil hopes, that it will lead to productions of the opera, real productions of the opera. We've never had a major opera production of Lord Byron. As a matter of fact, none of Virgil's works, except the initial performance of 4 scenes and 3 acts, has ever been done by a major opera company. And I hope it will. The situation now, and this included Rudolph Bing at the Met. Rudolph Bing didn't read music. Basically, the people that are running the impresarios, running opera companies and things like that, they don't read music. And in order to hear the opera and hear if they want to do it, you either have to have another production or you have to have a recording. And it was Virgil's ambition during all his later life to have a fine recording of Lord Byron, which we now have. And presumably the impresarios who put these on will listen to the CD of Lord Byron and say, hey, or as Jimmy would say, jeepers, I'd like to do a production of that opera. And that's the way it's done, as far as I can tell.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me. I admire your show and you, and I'll be listening to Fresh Air as I do.
Jack Larson is a poet and librettist. His opera Lord Byron, with music by Virgil Thompson, has just been released on Koch International.
But you know what's really amazing? We actually got through this whole thing without any help from Superman.
And, of course, you can still see Larson on TV playing Jimmy Olsen in the reruns of Superman. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's more music from Lord Byron.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with painter Larry Rivers about abstraction and realism, an artist's need to be selfish, and painting nudes. Rivers has been called a genius of the vulgar. He's written a memoir about his circle of painters, poets, and musicians in post-war New York. And writer Gary Paulson reads from his new memoir, Eastern Sun, Winter Moon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Jurors deliberated again today in the federal civil rights trial of four Los Angeles police officers accused of beating Rodney King. Kitty Feldy of member station KCRW reports.
For the eight men and four women, it's been a day of weighing the evidence, trying to decide whether officers used unreasonable force during the arrest of Rodney King and whether their commanding officer, Sergeant Stacy Kuhn, allowed them to commit the assault. Outside the courthouse, the NAACP and groups representing the Latino and Korean communities appealed for calm and called on the media to focus on what they see as the root causes of last year's unrest instead of the hysteria of riot preparation. Defense attorneys have been filling the news void, offering their opinions on jury progress. Ira Salzman said a deadlock would be a victory for his client, Stacy Kuhn, that predicted the government would pursue a third trial if this jury cannot agree on a verdict. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
President Clinton today used the traditional White House Easter egg roll to promote part of his economic stimulus bill. While hundreds of children looked for eggs, Mr. Clinton criticized Republican senators for blocking the spending package, which includes money for funding childhood immunizations. Senate Democrats have been unable to break a Republican filibuster. The president said today the children were the hostages of the Senate. Pentagon officials say a French jet participating in the enforcement of a no-fly zone over Bosnia crashed into the Adriatic Sea today. The French Defense Ministry says the crash was apparently due to mechanical problems. This is the first day of the NATO operation to police the skies over Bosnia. Meanwhile, on the ground, Serbian forces battered two Bosnian Muslim strongholds. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Belgrade.
As U.S., French, and Dutch jets patrolled the skies over Bosnia, and an operation called Deny Flight, the ground war continued unabated. The first flights took off in the early afternoon to meet the 2 p.m. start time, while Bosnian Serb gunners trained artillery shells on the center of the Bosnian capital, Sarajevo. It was the heaviest shelling in a month. The besieged Bosnian town of Srebrenica was also targeted today, despite a ceasefire. UN officials reported that dozens of civilians were killed and wounded in the artillery attacks. Bosnian Serb political and military leaders have angrily dismissed the NATO operation and said it would not stop their campaign against the Bosnian Muslims. They made good on their threat today. In Belgrade, this is Deborah Amos.
The UN Security Council has agreed to postpone voting on a resolution to impose sanctions against Serbia. Russia had asked for the delay, fearing that sanctions could hurt President Boris Yeltsin right before a referendum on his leadership. Many Russians feel a kinship with Serbia. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed higher today, gaining 31.5 points. This is NPR. In South Africa, some black groups are calling for widespread demonstrations and a strike to protest the Saturday assassination of black leader Chris Hani, apparently by a white man. Scattered protests and violence have occurred since his murder. The African National Congress is appealing for calm and condemned any revenge attacks on whites. The ANC plans demonstrations tomorrow and a strike on Wednesday. Memorial services are also scheduled for Wednesday. Police have arrested a Polish immigrant in connection with Hani's killing. Today they found a possible hit list of politicians and several guns in the suspect's home. In Waco, Texas, the FBI reports it's received a second letter from Branch Davidian cult leader David Koresh. Agents say it's filled with threats and doomsday passages from the Bible, and like a letter from Koresh on Friday, is written in the first person as a message from God. From Waco, Wade Goodwin has more.
David Koresh begins his letters to the FBI with the salutation, "Friends." but the letters are anything but friendly. One typical passage from Deuteronomy reads, "See now that I am he, and there is no God besides me. It is I that put to death and give life. I have wounded, and it is I who heal, and there is no one who can deliver my adversaries from my hand." The letters are signed Yahweh Koresh, the sacred name for God. The FBI is clearly concerned about this change in the tone of negotiations, though they still say they hold out some hope that the standoff could end peacefully. Though Koresh seems to want to provoke a confrontation, it seems that the Clinton administration does not. Today's Dallas Morning News reports that Clinton officials have refused to authorize aggression against the Branch Davidians, much to the FBI's frustration. For National Public Radio, I'm Wade Goodwin in Waco.
Astronauts aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery are getting ready to retrieve a satellite that's studying the sun. The effort begins tomorrow. The $6 million satellite carries two telescopes that examined how solar wind is generated. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The late poet Frank O'Hara once described his friend, the painter Larry Rivers, like this. Larry entered the scene like a demented telephone. Nobody knew whether to put it in the library, the kitchen, or the toilet, but it was electric. Rivers describes his life in a memoir called What Did I Do? Larry Rivers is one of the most prominent figurative painters to emerge during the period of abstract expressionism. As Carrie Rickey put it, he wedded representation with abstraction, parodied art history, anticipated by a decade the concerns of both the pop and color field painters, and prophetically engaged in what postmodernists might call appropriation and deconstruction. He says in his book he doesn't have the faith in self that abstract painters need. I asked him what he means.
I'm not the kind of painter who thinks, well, I did it, therefore it's got to be good or has meaning or things like that. And so if I put down an orange and a blue and put a line through it and then a big square shape and things like that, I felt as if there something necessary in carrying that off that I didn't have. I didn't sort of believe in it that way. I didn't really know what art was about in a certain way, or I still don't. You know, I'm not trying to be cute, but I don't really know what exactly it is about. And I can only get at those things that interest me. And I think I must also have something in my nature that wants people, more no matter who, from what part of life and things like that, to get something from the work.
Mm-hmm.
Something.
Now, often when you paint a figure, there's a feature that's missing, you know, like
yeah.
There's one eye, but the
yeah.
other eye is kind of blank. It hasn't been painted at
right.
all.
Yes.
How did you start doing that?
Well, I think there was a certain spontaneity in my work. In other words, if no matter what I was doing, I wanted it to come off sort of quickly or without too much trouble. And, you know, as yet I hadn't right to the point where I wanted things to look labored and that I really did a lot of hard work, which would be a reflection of a certain kind of good character. So the first eye, you don't have to worry about where you're placing. I mean, you just put it down somewhere below a brow or something like that. But when you come to the second eye, you really have to make calculations about how why they're part. There's no way of putting in a second eye unless you're Picasso to make it realistic without sort of real close judgment and changes and things that would slow you down, would make your hand work, let's say, from the knuckles instead of an arm movement. And I think that I just left it out at first. For those reasons, I didn't think it was necessary, really, what it amounted to. And I think there are other parts of the body missing, too, but people notice it in the face because the face is so clearly an image that we know all the parts of.
Something else you've done throughout most of your career is write on paintings. Sometimes the letters are stenciled, sometimes handwritten.
Yeah.
Sometimes parts of letters are missing or blurred. How did you start using words on paintings?
Well, I think that, don't forget the Cubists had the word journal. I mean, they would have a newspaper in their painting. So in other words, I didn't do anything that was that, new. The only thing is, I think I was bolder about it and didn't hide it in a certain way. And it also, in certain paintings, it's almost the point of the painting. I did these vocabulary lessons, which obviously are words and features. And I thought there was something sort of ironic, I suppose, in all that. And please forgive me for trying to be ironic, but That was one of the reasons. Also, my hand is a very, artistic one in the sense that I make gestures with my paint and they're like loose flowing and things like that. Whereas a letter has sharp edges and it's very much more definite than the painting. So the combination of this very definite thing plus this loose, you know, arty kind of work with colors all over the place seemed to make me happy.
You married when you were pretty young.
Yes.
Your girlfriend got pregnant, and that's right. How you ended up getting married. She already had a son.
Right.
But you didn't want a family. In fact, you wrote, "My life was not going to be about living. It was going to be about art."
Right.
So you felt pretty trapped by having a family.
I guess so. I given my personality, I probably didn't even feel trapped. I nothing was going to stop me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've felt a little bit something. Don't forget, I never really gave them up, and eventually I really brought them up. I brought up these boys and lived with the woman's mother. I lived with my wife's mother. I didn't live with the wife. So it's complicated looking it over. I mean, I was not going to be stopped from what I wanted to do, but at the same time, I wasn't going to abandon the boys or, you know, the mother. And we lived together, and they were very helpful in many ways.
Do you think that you couldn't have become an artist without being somewhat selfish?
That's right. I think I modeled myself on my distorted notion of what Picasso was about. I thought that somewhere along the line I had heard that, without reading it somewhere, that Picasso, you know, walked away from every relationship and children and things like that, and all that life was about was art. And I felt that that model was something that it was of interest to me.
Looking back, do you think that you behaved badly toward your family?
Some people might. I don't think I behaved badly. I made up for it. In one way, I was sort of, you know, on my own, selfish, things like that, but at the same time, I provided for them. And so it's not very different than what most men are about. They go to offices 8-10 hours a day, and they come back and don't bother me. They're looking at television or a newspaper, they're drinking a beer or whatever it is, and then the child walks in, they give them a 2-minute kiss, and maybe once a year they go somewhere for 3 weeks or something. I don't think life is that different, you know, among for myself and other people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My guess is
selfish. I would never deny that I'm selfish, but I can make a case for everybody being selfish.
Mm-hmm. My guess is the artist Larry Rivers. He has a new autobiography called What Did I Do? We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is the artist Larry Rivers. He has a new autobiography. Now, your mother-in-law, who you lived with for many years, you painted her naked a couple of times.
Yes.
And I'll just describe her physically briefly. She's you know, an older woman, kind of heavy, an almost what we describe as peasant-like body.
Okay.
Is it fair?
I never heard that expression about a body. Go ahead. But anyway, you mean the painting that's in the Whitney Museum? It's Birdie Twice?
Birdie Twice, yeah. Why did you want... You know, it seems like a real taboo, don't you think, to paint your mother-in-law naked?
Well, I told my mother-in-law, if you read the book, that part, I said to Birdie, she sort of said, "Why do you want to paint me?" You know, she had the simple notion that an artist wants to paint beautiful things. She looked at herself. She didn't think she was beautiful. So I said, Rembrandt painted older women. I forget her name. Anyway, she's got her 2 feet in a stream, and she has a kind of a gown raised up. And she's not a young woman. Now, you didn't see her breast, but there are others that Rembrandt did where you do see this older woman. I thought that I had a very special opportunity. I was able to get someone that age, close to me, who actually I could really look at and see what was going on. So it had two levels. I painted it to make a painting and things like that, but I couldn't help be aware of what, you know, happens to the body. I was actually amazed that it looked that good. What I mean, I'm talking about on a sexual level. She didn't really seem to me to be unattractive.
Were you uncomfortable, or was she uncomfortable when she was posing for you?
I certainly wasn't uncomfortable. I felt that she maybe the first few times, then she sort of, it was okay. It was a son-in-law, you know, she thought that anything she could do to help. Mm-hmm. I told her, you know, that maybe we'll sell that painting, something. So she actually thought she was posing for the good reason, a working-class woman who thought that, you know, we would make some money or something like that. And
did you?
Did I? I think I, when I sold those paintings, they weren't very expensive and things like that. I made something, sure. But I wish I had a lot of them today. I would have made more.
Now, you also did a naked painting of your son, Joe,
yep.
when he was 14. And
right.
there's a part in your book where he talks about what it was like
yes.
to be painted by you. And he wrote that he wanted to be immortalized in your paintings, but he didn't really want to hang around and pose nude for it. He was 14 at the time.
Right.
In the painting, he's nude except for his socks. He
right.
says his pubic hair was just coming in.
Right.
And then the portrait was shown at the Southampton Gallery in Long Island, New York, and half of the high school from that area had their parental permission to go to the gallery.
Right.
And he was very embarrassed.
Until yeah, in other words, to walk into that gallery, they'd have a note from their parents that they could walk into that gallery. Go ahead.
And then finally the police removed the painting
right.
of your son, and he
right.
was relieved. And he says to this day he has a twinge of embarrassment when he sees it.
Yeah.
Did you realize he was going to feel that way, that, you know, at the age of 14
no,
it was going to be no, kind of embarrassing?
It was all very jolly, like I suppose a lot of families in which, you know, you don't, there's a central pot everybody's dipping into, and that's the sort of the ones that don't speak of the dark things. I think that he may have felt that way, but maybe I even thought about it, but I didn't think it was anything too anything too much to ask of a child, truthfully speaking. And I think he actually, you know, he did. He knew he was a painter, and that's what I do, and that he would be useful. If he was embarrassed, I'm sorry. You know, so what?
You were very close with the poet Frank O'Hara. You,
right.
were, you were lovers for a while, even
yes.
though you don't think of yourself as homosexual and have, you know,
right.
been married
twice.
I was
twice so straight I could be homosexual.
But you're right that you started thinking of yourself for the first time as sexually attractive
yeah.
when you started hanging out in homosexual circles.
Right.
How did that affect you?
Well, how did it affect me? Well, I just said it. To feel sexually attractive is rather pleasant. But I think that I didn't get that. I'm not saying that that's why I got interested in men, but that there was that difference in my existence, that women didn't talk about, you know, some guy with a great ass or, you know, a great basket, as the homosexual talk at that time, and the area around the fly as it's telling you what's going on inside it. But it was sort of interesting. I mean, it brought me up to another level about sex, that I, too, could be, you know, exciting to someone is really what it amounted to. Now, I really wanted it to be with women. They would go to bed with you, but I never got the feeling that they went to bed with you because you were sexually exciting. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of silly. I feel now like a baby. I can't see how they could have not thought that. Why would they go to bed with me? They wanted to have sex with me. But I never interpreted it that way.
When you were younger, you were part of a circle of artists, musicians, poets, and I mean, there were even like artist bars to hang out in. Is there anything in your life like that now?
No. I have a band, but there's no place. You have personal friends. And I don't go to bars. It's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing because people know you, or
no, not because people know me. It's that you. I just the thing. I thought bars were a place to go to try to pick up someone. Forgive me. And to the idea of sitting there with this notion in my mind, looking the way I do, and, you know, getting the treatment of Mr. Rivers, you know, where you're no longer a possibility for a liaison, but just some, you know, respected citizen of Southampton or wherever you are, or they don't even know. It's just, it's too obvious. And I think that it just doesn't work anymore.
Okay.
So I stay home and paint.
Larry Rivers, his memoir is called What Did I Do? This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on the Balkans?
Oh, Deborah Amos reports today on the first day of enforcement of the no-fly zone over Bosnia by NATO aircraft. Also on intensified shelling of Srebrenica, the Muslim town in East Bosnia. Also, Trevor Rowe from the United Nations on a postponement of a vote on tougher sanctions against Serbia. That postponement was evidently agreed to with an eye toward the referendum that Boris Yeltsin faces in Russia later this month, a referendum in which it's thought he would fare worse if he had to take a strong anti-Serb stand. Also, the latest in the trial of the four Los Angeles police officers and what it means to violate someone's civil rights with intent.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of the most popular Fresh Air interviews of the past year was with Gary Paulsen, a writer best known for his adventure books for young people, such as Dog Song, Hatchet, and The Winter Room. He's recently started writing books for adults. We invited him to read an excerpt of his new memoir, Eastern Sun, Winter Moon. It's about growing up during World War II in the United States and the Philippines, and the difficult, sometimes harrowing experiences he had at home and in the world. The excerpt he's about to read involves a traumatic experience from his childhood, and the language reflects the fear and horror of the moment. Listener discretion is advised. This reading is from the opening of Eastern Sun, Winter Moon.
Mother and I spent the war years in Chicago. My father was on Patton's staff and left with him in 1939, just after I was born, to train and then to fight in Africa and Europe, and I did not see him to know him again until I was 7 years old. Mother worked at a munitions factory on swing shift, where she ran a machine that made belted 20-millimeter ammunition. At first, when we went to Chicago and she worked, she would stay home on the weekends when she didn't have to be at the factory. We were alone a lot then, and she made me take naps in the afternoon with her, which I hated, but she made me take anyway. And on one afternoon, I was supposed to be napping, I found part of Mother I had never seen but would never forget. I'd grown some wile, even that young, and had devised a way to sneak off. I would pretend to go to sleep, lying next to her in the bed, and when I did that, she would doze off herself. These were warm summer afternoons in an unair-conditioned apartment, and the hot air off the street blew the cheap curtains in small puffs, and dozing came very naturally for her after the hard work of the week. As soon as I sensed her going to sleep, I would begin to slide toward the bottom of the bed an inch at a time until I made it to the foot of the bed, and then carefully, so carefully, to the floor. Freedom. If I remained quiet, she might sleep for an hour or more, and I could play and enjoy myself. I didn't often do anything wrong. Played with toys on the kitchen floor where the pattern of the linoleum made lines that could become roads for my small metal cars and trucks and war toys. But sometimes rather other opportunities presented themselves. On one afternoon I was successful and had begun to play when I saw that the apartment door was open a bit. I decided to go outside. I grabbed my stuffed dog with one eye and dragged it bumping down the back stairs and out into the alley. It was a wonderful, mysterious, and forbidden world, the alley. I was allowed to play outside only when supervised, or when Mother was awake, and now I seemed to be off on some great adventure. Near the apartment was a billboard with a large pack of Lucky Strikes and the green pack facing out to the street. The billboard angled back toward the apartment, and where it ran into the wall, it made a hidden, darkened corner. I no sooner made the area next to the billboard when I had to pee, and I went back into the corner so nobody would see me. I set Dog on the ground and was busy taking care of the problem when I sensed a dark shape looming in the opening between the billboard and wall, and turned to see a man. He was huge and dark, ugly, and he smelled of old wine and vomit and urine, with dirt grimed into his face so hard it seemed to crack when he smiled. Yellow teeth, all ugly, and I had fear so that my feet seemed riveted to the ground. "Well," he said, his smile widened, "fresh young meat." We were from a place where we did not understand such things as this man. Mother had once quietly, simply, told me never to take candy bars from strangers, but had never told me why. It seemed a very silly thing to tell me without a reason. But even with that ignorance, I knew that this man meant me harm, and I grabbed Dog and tried to run past him. It was no good. With one hand, he clawed the back of my shirt and stopped me and lifted me off the ground, so close to his face that I could smell the stink of him even more. And with his other hand, he fumbled with his fly. "It's perfect," he said, "like Christmas, coming on you this way. Perfect." And I should have run or kicked or screamed or done something, anything, but all I could do was hang there in fear, still holding Dog by one ear, hang like a mouse caught by a cat, waiting for something I couldn't understand to happen. Stunned into shock, waiting, hanging and waiting, and something hit the man so hard in the back of the head that snot sprayed out of his nose. "No!" My mother's voice exploded in the small area. Well, it was more than her voice. There was some wild thing in it, some snarling, ripping thing that made it powerful, all-powerful. And when she hit the man again in the back of his head, he dropped me. "Run," she yelled at me, "run for the house." I took her at her word, but I only made the corner. There I stopped because a man and a woman, the people who lived in the apartment across from us, were coming to help. I turned then, knowing I was protected, but if anybody needed help, it was the man. He was on the ground, and Mother was kicking at him. "Not with him, you son of a bitch," she screamed. "Not with mine, you don't. God damn, God damn, God damn." And she kept kicking him, even when he was down. Not just wild kicks, but careful ones. She walked around him, waiting until she could find an uncovered spot, and then she would kick, hard and deep, in his groin, his back. And when he would move his hands to protect one area, she'd kick in another. And when at last his hands quit moving and he lay still, she aimed careful kicks at his temples. Aimed perfect, almost dainty kicks with the hard steel toe of her work shoes until he didn't move at all, and I looked up to see her eyes then. There was a great brilliant rawness in them, a wild anger and savagery that made my breath stop, and I felt sorry for the man without really knowing why. He could not win, could not live, could not be while she lived, and she could get to him. The man could not be. It was not that she was killing him, though she was, and not that he was being punished for what he had done or nearly done to me. It was that he could not be, could not exist. In her eyes, in her look, there was no room left for him in all the world. He would end. "You bastard," she said in a low voice, almost a hiss, kicking him carefully. He had by this time messed his pants, and the fresh smell of crap and piss filled a small space by the wall. "You son of a bitch, not him, not mine, you don't, not ever you don't, not ever with mine, you son of a bitch, son of a bitch, son of a bitch." And I think now he was dead. Looking back, that he was dead and gone. His head looked soft, pulpy, with spit coming out of his mouth, and the humanness was leaving him. But the couple who had come to help me took me away then so they couldn't see anymore, took me back to our apartment. A short time later, Mother came back upstairs and sat with me in the kitchen chair next to the table with the oilcloth covered with blue leaves and cleaned her shoes with a damp rag from the sink, her fingers shaking. "You must never do that again," she said when she was done. And I cried because of what I had seen, not in the old man and his death, but in her eyes. Cried because it frightened me, and she held me while I cried it out. I was more afraid now than I had been while it was happening. What was that man going to do to me? But she didn't answer. She held me close and rocked back and forth while I cried, and then she made some Ovaltine, and I drank it while she went out in the hall to talk to some police who came to the door.
Gary Paulson, reading from his new memoir, Eastern Sun, Winter Moon. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Jerry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Admiral William Crow. He served as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Presidents Reagan and Bush. In the last election, he supported Bill Clinton for president and is now chairing the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.